Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This movie afforded me the opportunity to go back to my more recent lineage, 100 years or so, and go back to, the Mississippi, a state that I had never been to.
In this holiday special, we speak to celebrated Hollywood director Ryan Coogler about his blockbuster new film, Sinners, a horror film about two brothers fighting an evil force in Jim Crow era 1930s Mississippi. Then to the case of death row prisoner Keith Lamar.
My name is Keith Lamar. I'm a poet, author, and musician. For the past 31 years, I've been in solitary confinement, buried under the never-ending agony of sensory deprivation. On January the 13th, 2027, the state of Ohio intends to kill me. I'm innocent.
We'll speak to Keith Lamar on death row in Ohio and air a new short film about him, illustrated by Molly Crabapple. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's holiday special looking at the new critically acclaimed blockbuster, Sinners, written and directed by the celebrated filmmaker Ryan Coogler. It's already become one of the highest-grossing horror films in history. Set in 1932 in the Mississippi Delta during Jim Crow, the film has two stars, Smoke and Stack. They're both played by actor Michael B. Jordan, identical twin brothers who've just returned to their hometown after years living in Chicago working for gangster Al Capone. The twins purchase an old sawmill from a racist white landowner to start a juke joint for the local black community when they're confronted by a supernatural evil. Also starring in Sinners is Delroy Lindo, who plays Delta Slim, a down-and-dirty piano player. Oh, and did I say it's a vampire flick? This is the film's trailer.
I've been all over this world. I've seen men die in ways I ain't even know was possible. Love you, brother. Be careful. I will. With all the things that I've seen, I ain't ever seen no demons, no ghosts, no magic. Till now.
You get back inside.
With the devil. One day he's gonna follow you home.
Sinners, the new blockbuster horror film written and directed by Ryan Coogler. His other feature films include Fruitvale Station, Creed, and the record-breaking Black Panther, and its sequel, Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. I recently spoke to Ryan Coogler shortly after Sinners premiered. Ryan, it's great to have you back on Democracy Now! After we talked to you in Sundance more than a decade ago. This is an astounding film. Talk about how you developed the idea for this and wrote it. I mean, this horror film, this film about everything from Jim Crow to slavery, the magnificent music, and the fact that you made it a vampire film.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's such a great such a great group of questions. You know, like, to be honest with you, my family is like many families in California. We products of the second wave of the Great Migration, meaning that, you know, before California, my family was in the South, in the Gulf states primarily, but also some of them were in Mississippi. And it's ironic because with my grandmother and her mom before her and my mom are known for is their gumbo. They cook a style of gumbo that comes from Port Arthur, Texas. And as you know, that the dish is probably most famous in Louisiana, but it's combining a lot of different elements into one uniform dish that's beloved. My family is known for making some of the best gumbo, and this was my opportunity to make some cinematic gumbo. You know, I took some things that might seem disparate, you know, in a description, but I think they go very well together. You know, I grew up in Oakland, and one of the most important people in my life was my Uncle James Edmondson, who was a Mississippi man who married my grandmother's younger sister, Sammy, who the main character in the film is named after. But for a considerable amount of time, he was the oldest male member of my family, and I just really loved spending time with him. And all he wanted to do when he was off from work was listen to blues music, drink old Taylor whiskey, and maybe catch a game of San Francisco Giants on the radio. You know, and I associated that music with him. You know, I never felt like it belonged to me. It felt like it was music for, you know, for older people. But he passed away in 2015. And I was devastated. I was away from home, as I normally was, making a film called Creed, when I got the news. And after he passed, I started to listen to old blues records to kind of remind myself of him. And if I did it enough, I would feel like he was there with me, almost like I was conjuring his spirit. And the base of the idea started with that. And when I started to do my research on blues music, specifically the Delta blues music that came out of that Mississippi Delta, I discovered that, you know, there's a firm argument to be made that this art form, the Delta blues, is our country's most important contribution to global popular culture. You know, I think it's probably our most important artistic contribution to the world. And it was such a profound discovery that you know, this music made by people who were, you know, for all intents and purposes, living under a backbreaking form of American apartheid. You know, denied that humanity on a daily basis would create something so artistically excellent that it would affect, you know, global culture, you know, from that time forward. And that was what I sought to make. I sought to make something personal and true, but also epic and mythical. You know, I grew up loving horror stories in literature and in cinema. You know, so I combined that as well. You know, I had an appetite for showing more of myself, you know, after having over a decade working in franchise filmmaking, you know, if that makes sense. I was very passionate about those projects, but those projects weren't completely my own. So I was excited to incorporate some elements of genres and styles that I was interested in. But also, the last thing I'll tell you, Amy, was through my research into the music, I learned more about the music industry and the music business as it was built out, and how much the concept of genre is related to racism. You know, the classification of different types of music. You have a song sung by a black artist, and a white artist can sing that same song in homage to that artist. And the industry would say, hey, this black person's song, we're gonna put that in one category. Back then, it might've been called race records. And then this other white musician will invent a new genre to keep a separation here of these groups of people. Maybe we'll call that bluegrass, or we'll call it country, or we'll call it rock and roll. You know, even though it was the same song sung the same way, they were looking at the color of the skin of the person who was singing it and enforcing that apartheid, even through the artistic business model. So I wanted to make a film that was kind of raging against the concept of genre and making the audience constantly question it, even while they were watching it, whether that's genres of music or genres of filmmaking.
Talk about what it was like for you going into the Deep South to make this film. I mean, you made the film around New Orleans, is that right? And the culture there, and your past work, and your journeys to Africa with Zinzi, your wife,
Yeah, absolutely. So, this movie was a very interesting opportunity for me to do some research about my lineage. And I had that opportunity before with the Panther films. And in that situation, you know, me being a foundational Black American, you know, my family has been here, you know, for over 400 years, essentially, you know, in North America. But you know, the Panther films allowed me to travel back to the continent of Africa and spend time there and you know, and contemplate our distant ancestry as it relates to the continent, as it relates to the diaspora. This movie afforded me the opportunity to go back to my more recent lineage, you know, 100 years or so, you know, and go back to, you know, the Mississippi, a state that I had never been to. You know, I'm almost 40 years old. And my matrilineal grandfather was born in Mississippi. You know, my uncle, who was so important to my life, was there until he was a young man, and I had never been. And it was a beautiful experience to go on that blues trail and spend time in those places. But it also was a harrowing experience at the same time. I went to Dockery Plantation in the Mississippi Delta, which is, you know, thought to be, you know, maybe the place where the first true Delta blues song was played by a man called Charlie Patton. And when you go, you know, you realize that they were making this music in slave quarters, you know, and there was just this immense wealth that was owned by this plantation, like the amount of fertile land that you'll see, the amount of crops that you'll see, you know, and that it was also a place where most people, you know, were denied access to these resources. They were backbreakingly poor, you know. And then at that time, often these were enslaved people, you know, weren't being paid anything, you know. So for me, to know that my family had history there, and I was touching down in that place for the first time, it was a level of guilt there for me, but there was also a level of wonder to know what my recent ancestors were endured, you know what I mean, and were able to survive, and were able to make plans and affirm their humanity and affect the world, you know, with their culture.
So, what's it like working with your wife? I mean, you credit her with so much. You co-produced the film with her. What's it like working with Zinzi on this masterpiece?
I mean, it's great, man. Zinzi is is my favorite person in the world. You know, I've been around her a long time, and still somehow it feels like it's not long enough. You know, you know, she knows me really well. We're very different. You know, which is very helpful. We got two different communication styles, two different ways of seeing the world. So in general, if I have a situation that I can't crack, you know, because she comes at things with a different angle, normally she can crack it very easily, you know?
You know, I remember first meeting you and Zinzi back in 2013. It was at the Sundance Film Festival. You had just introduced Fruitvale. I said, would you be willing to come in at 5:30 because the show is at 6? You said, yep, I'm there. You said, because your uncle, Clarence Thomas, not the justice, yeah, but the Secretary
not
General
the
of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, had been on the show, loved it. And I said to you, can you give a message to him? Look directly into the camera, and you said, hi, Uncle Bud. But having said that, I wanted to go to the second part of that conversation. As you talked at that point, I think you were working at the San Francisco, the Juvenile Detention Center. You just come out with Fruitvale.
The Youth Guidance Center, yep.
So let's go to that clip.
I've never been homeless in my life. I always had a home. When I first went to film school, however, because it was such a sporadic thing, I went down to Los Angeles, you know, and I didn't have anywhere to stay yet. So I kind of had to jump start in classes and things like that. For about a week and a half, you know what I mean? I was you know, getting dressed in my car, spending most of my time in school, you know, until I found a place. But I bumped around quite a bit. I stayed with some Jesuits. You know what I mean? With a group of Jesuits that were in training, basically. I stayed with like a distant relative for a day or two. But I found my car to kind of be a safe haven for a little bit. You know, before I got an apartment.
So, Ryan, that's you back in 2013 telling your life story. You had just done Fruitvale, first time working with, as you have from then on, with Michael B. Jordan. I don't think most people know that part of your life, what that meant.
Yeah, it happened very fast for me in terms of like... The decision to go to Los Angeles and become a filmmaker, you know, and I went down there without everything figured out, you know, I ended up needing a lot of support from a lot of different people, and I'm still close with all of those people. I'm a product of so much support that's been poured into me. You know, from likely sources, but also very unlikely sources.
I wanted to play that clip from 2013. It's not so long ago. It's a dozen years ago. And talk about what you negotiated in making Sinners, the arrangement you had with Warner Brothers. The New York Times reports Warner Brothers agreed to spend $90 million to make Sinners and agreed to give you a cut of gross ticket sales, now rare arrangement known as first dollar gross, meaning before they recoup their costs, you're getting money as well. Warner also agreed, and this is absolutely key, to relinquish its ownership of the film to you after 25 years. The Times reports, quote, some rival film companies were horrified that Warner Brothers would give a film away even after a period of time. Talk about these key components of your contract and why this was so critical for you, Ryan Coogler.
That's a great question. I mean, what I will do is I'll maybe add some context that maybe those articles didn't add. I'm not the first filmmaker to get any of these deals, you know, and Warner Brothers is not the first studio to provide these deals to a filmmaker. You know, so like I think that a lot has been made of my deal in particular. I'm not totally sure why. You know, I have my guesses. You know, but I've been in the industry long enough to know what kind of deals are possible, and nothing about this deal is a new thing. You know,
what's your guesses,
Ryan?
It's
not a con. I'd rather not say. but you know, like the attention on what's happening with this project, you know, outside of it as a piece of art and as a piece of commerce has been very interesting, you know. But for me, you know, this film was very important to me. As a writer director, I've made over $2 billion at the global box office. I'm not yet 40 years old. It's taken a lot time, commitment, energy, and I've missed out on a lot of things in my life. Making films that will always be owned by other people. For this one, because it was so personal. And because I had the ability to negotiate, you know, I asked for a few things that were very important to me for this project, you know, and for what it was about and what it meant to me and my family. And thankfully, you know, I was able to get those things I was asking for from Warner Brothers.
Well, Ryan, I know you have to go, but reading from The Guardian, you're widely considered the highest grossing black director in history. Your film Black Panther became the highest grossing film of all time, directed by an African-American director, grossing over $1.3 billion worldwide. I can't believe I'm saying to you, what do you have to say to young directors? Because you are a young director, but as Sinners comes out, what you want people to take away from it and how you want to inspire, I was going to say the next generation, but actually your generation.
Well, Well, look, I'm what's called an elder millennial. You know, it's a generation of filmmakers coming up behind me, like that's Gen Z, they'll call them Zoomers. But for them, I think they have an incredible advantage to just having grown up with, you know, with smartphones in their pockets. You know, I don't think that's an advantage for their psychology, you know what I'm saying? Like, but it is an advantage for their filmmaking abilities, you know, to have access to this type of technology constantly. And I think that the movies that I see them make, when I look at things on the internet, I'm just always kind of blown away by the editing style and the way that they see the world. And we need their movies. You know, look, for me, a lot of my business success has been put in the context of me being black. You know, and I think that that's a part of, the issue when people write about, you know, what my films have done. You know, I'll say this: the year Panther One came out. Yes, it was the highest grossing film ever made by a black person. It was also the highest grossing film domestically that year made by anybody. You know, and for some reason that was never talked about. You know, and for me, what I'll speak to, and after coming off of, you know, this movie and researching Delta Blues music, you know, it's music made by people who the state was built to make it so that they had nothing, to make it so that they had to be sharecroppers. You know what I mean? To make it so that they couldn't leave. To make it so that, that some of these plantations were so massive that they had their own currency and their own banking systems that they would pay them with. You know, they were able to make art that changed the world. That art became rock and roll. That art became the country music empire. That art became hip hop. You know, that art became house music. You know, like the fact that their stories were so amazing and so valuable, even though they were being told that they were worthless. You know what I mean? Even though they were told that they didn't deserve anything. You know, that has stuck with me. And for me, you know, what I would say to not just young filmmakers, like I think that it's filmmakers of all ages that have yet to make their first movie. You know, so what I would say to aspiring filmmakers, you know, regardless of their age, aspiring filmmakers that are just removed from where you were when you met me in 2013, right? I would say, go make your movie. Go make your movie. Even if people are telling you that what you want to make a movie about is not important, keep going. Find a person who will support you. You know what I mean? Get better at your craft and go get it done. You know what I mean? So that you're no longer an aspiring filmmaker. You are just a filmmaker who's looking to make your next thing.
Acclaimed director Ryan Coogler, the writer, producer, director of the new film Sinners, which has already become one of the highest grossing horror films in history. His past films include Fruitvale Station, Creed, and the record-breaking Black Panther and its sequel, Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. Coming up, we go to Death Row in Ohio to speak with prisoner Keith Lamar. Stay with us. Jazz legend Randy Weston performing on Democracy Now! In 2012. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this holiday special, we turn now to the case of Ohio death row prisoner Keith Lamar. He's featured in an incredible new animated short film called The Injustice of Justice, illustrated by the artist Molly Crabapple. The film recently won the grand prize for the best animated short film at the Golden State Film Festival. This is The Injustice of Justice.
My name is Keith Lamar. I'm a poet, author, and musician. For the past 31 years, I've been in solitary confinement. buried under the never-ending agony of sensory deprivation. On January the 13th, 2027, the state of Ohio intends to kill me. I'm innocent. Thousands of people around the country and the world have rallied around my cause, joining me in my demand for justice. Here's my story. When I was 19 years old and selling drugs, a group of would-be robbers in search of money forced their way into my apartment. A shootout ensued, and regrettably, I took someone's life and was myself shot twice in the legs. Facing a long prison sentence, and on the advice of counsel, I pled guilty to murder and was sentenced to serve 18 years to life. Determined to redeem myself and make good on my potential, I completed my GED, enrolled in college, and became a voracious reader in an attempt to repair myself to society. I was in the fourth year of my sentence when, in 1993, a riot erupted inside the prison. Apparently, a group of Muslim prisoners on religious grounds refused to submit to mandatory tuberculosis testing and were given an ultimatum: take the test or else. Amid rumors of a forced inoculation, the Muslims took over the prison in protest, releasing some 400 prisoners from their cells and setting into motion an 11-day standoff that would ultimately claim the lives of one guard and nine prisoners. I was on the recreation yard when it all began. A guard came running out of the building with blood streaming down his face, followed by a masked prisoner who was carrying a weapon and yelling, "We've taken over." Against my better judgment, I went inside to check on my personal belongings. A fatal mistake. It was complete chaos. When I made it to my assigned location, I discovered that it was being used as a holding area for hostages, both guards and prisoners. I was thereafter approached by a masked prisoner who gave me the option to either participate or leave. I chose to leave. Hundreds of us gathered on the yard, waiting as the National Guard and Highway Patrol took up watch outside the perimeter fence. Later, when dead bodies were dumped into the yard, they stood by and did nothing. It was as if I was trapped inside a nightmare. Around 2 a.m. the following morning, we were rounded up and herded into the gymnasium, where we were stripped naked and then violently forced in random groups of 10 into cells meant for one person. Stressed and stretched to the limit, a fight broke out over food. Tragically, I stood back and watched as a man named Dennis Weaver was held down by three prisoners and choked to death. It was a cowardly thing to do, and I can now see and admit that. But at the time, I was worried about my own life. When I was later questioned by authorities, I claimed to have been asleep. It was my way of telling them that I didn't want to be involved. But it was too late. Because I had gone into the hostage area without wearing a mask, my name would be mentioned among a vast array of potential suspects. Even though the state concedes that I was never affiliated with any of the gangs said to have presided over the riot, the fact that I was already serving time for murder would play a big part in their decision to indict me. Ultimately, I was charged with 9 counts of aggravated murder. I couldn't believe it. Mind you, it was never expected that I would actually demand a trial. He copped out once, he'll cop out again, was the prevailing belief. In fact, no sooner than I was indicted, I was offered a deal. Plead guilty and we'll run the time concurrent with the time you're already serving. In other words, I would have gotten off easier had I actually killed someone. But why me? Why was I singled out for this undeserved retribution? It's a good question, one that I've spent the better part of 3 decades trying to explain. Here's what I can tell you. When the riot came to an end, overzealous officials rushed into the prison without first securing the massive crime scene, rendering inadmissible some 22,000 pieces of evidence. So there was absolutely no evidence to link anyone to crimes. This meant the state had to rely solely on the uncorroborated testimony of jailhouse informants, the most unreliable witnesses of all. What to do? Well, the first thing the state did was enlist the help and expertise of the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. This was not a random selection. Hamilton County has the dubious distinction of convicting and executing more than half of all death row prisoners in the United States. And how have they been so successful? The answer is simple and deadly. Through the impaneling of all white juries, the use of paid jailhouse informants, and the intentional withholding of exculpatory evidence. I have now in my possession the statement of an actual perpetrator who admitted to murdering someone for whom I was sentenced to death. And this is only the tip of the iceberg. They withheld so much more. It's over 3 decades later now, and I'm still in solitary confinement, being tortured because I refused to plead guilty to something I didn't do. I'm innocent. Look, we kid ourselves when we speak of justice. Until we have a process that holds everyone equally accountable for their actions, this system will remain what it has always been, a punishment system. And as we all know, those who don't have the capital get the punishment.
That's the new award-winning short film, The Injustice of Justice, illustrated by the renowned artist Molly Crabapple. Coming up, we speak to Keith Lamar on death row in the Ohio Correctional Penitentiary, where he's been held for over 30 years, much of it in solitary confinement. Late great Randy Weston, performing for Democracy Now! In 2012. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end this holiday special with Keith Lamar in his own words, speaking from death row in Ohio. Keith Lamar has been imprisoned for 36 years, 32 years in solitary confinement, 30 years on death row. His self-published memoir is Condemned, The Whole Story. Keith Lamar is also releasing a new album on May 30th titled Live from Death Row. It documents a 2023 concert in Brooklyn when Lamar performed via the phone with a group of acclaimed musicians, including the pianist Albert Marquez. Well, on May 31st, Marquez will lead an album release party concert with Keith Lamar joining from death row at Joe's Pub here in New York. I recently spoke with Keith Lamar by phone about life on death row and the growing campaign to save his life. I asked him, what's it like to live on death row?
Well, I think the opposite word is lived on death row. I've lived. You know, early on when I first came here, I met and was mentored by this older gentleman named Snoop. He the one who turned me on to jazz. He the one who really introduced me to literature, serious books, books that ultimately changed my self-concept. And but this is a soul-crushing environment. You see a lot of young people coming here without the means and resources to fend off the ills, the ravages of being in this type of place. Because sensory deprivation it robs you of your humanity. And you know, before long, you know, you see these young guys unraveling. So seeing that, being in proximity to that kind of pain, has been really, really devastating. But, you know, I share books. I share my understanding and wisdom I've accumulated with the young people around me. So I more or less work for this system, you know, but in a proactive way, trying to, you know, help young people in the ways in which I myself was helped. You know, I am, you know, in possession of my faculties because other people helped me. And so I try to extend that help in return. Yeah. But this is a soul-crushing environment, definitely.
Can you talk about the making of this film, explaining your case and what you're hoping to accomplish right now? You have made this film. You do live concerts that are performed around the world, remarkably, where you're joining from Death Row. You have book clubs where your own book is read, but where you also lead in discussion of other books as well with high schools and other places. Talk about your message, Keith.
Well, I, you know, from the very beginning, just wanted to stand on my innocence. You know, it was never really a matter of me not wanting to speak out, to stand up for myself. But that was the whole point of me demanding the trial. You know, but the whole system, I soon found out, is centered around obedience, around operating within prescribed parameters and whatnot. And I was advised to remain quiet during my trial and thereafter, and I did. You know, I went along with it. You know, that's what we do. And, you know, other smarter, more learned people would speak on my behalf, would stand up and fight for my life, you know, and I believe that. And I just kept going deeper and deeper into the darkness until I found myself in this really, really desperate place where I was really standing on the brink of my existence. You know, I had to find out the hard way that in order for my life to be mine, that I had to stand up and claim it. You know, so that was really the thing that was the catalyst that pushed me to start speaking up and reaching to utilize my own agency. And all of these things that you just mentioned is a product of that general thrust, you know, that thing that just coming to the conclusion that if I don't stand up right now, then I might lose my life. And so that was the thing that kind of started the movie. You know, I first started, I wrote the book that you mentioned, Condemned, and that was over 200 pages. And not long after that, a dear friend of mine, Lloyd Swain, and produced a documentary, which was 30 minutes. And so we was trying to figure out a way to condense it even more because, you know, of course, people have short attention spans. We understand, I understand that people have their own problems, have their own lives to live. And so, you know, it's asking a lot to ask someone to sit down and read a 200-some page book or a 30-minute documentary. But we thought that we could condense the story into a 7-minute short, then possibly that could garner more attention. So that was the whole impetus behind creating the movie.
Keith Lamar, in your book Condemned, about Bobby Sands, if you can explain who he is, his hunger strike, and how it inspired you to go on a hunger strike, which led to your case being known. I mean, you've been written about in the New York Times. You have jazz greats playing with you, supporting your cause.
Yeah, one of my friends who I think you might know named Stoughton Lynn was a famous historian, social activist. He, in the beginning, when I was first sentenced to death row, he somehow found his way into my life. And he sent me that book by Bobby Sands, Nothing But an Unfinished Song, written by Dennis O'Hearn, who has since become a very close friend of mine. He sent me that book, and as I was reading it, it felt as if I was being sent a message. You know, I had been pleading with these people, it was going on 18 years in a civil suit with 8 years, all to no avail. And, you know, I was reading this book, and it was almost a last-ditch effort before I was about to give up. And Bobby Sands and his comrade, Bobby Sands, for those who don't know, was the Irish prisoner who, along with several of his comrades, went on the hunger strike in Ireland. And, you know, some of their demands were very basic, just to be treated as human beings, which, of course, resonated with me. And not long after I finished that book, I reached out to the author, Dennis O'Hearn. I wrote him. We struck up a correspondence. He came to see me. We became really close friends. And I decided to undergo a hunger, enact a hunger strike myself, along with several other prisoners here at the Supermax, went on hunger strike. And after 18 years of not being able to break through court cases and all that, in 12 days of being on a hunger strike, I was sitting in the visiting room with my family. Mm-hmm. And that was like a seminal moment in my journey. It kind of taught me that if anything is going to change, you have to stand up and speak out, you know, on your own. And, you know, one of my literary heroes, Richard Wright, he wrote in his book, Black Boy, that if you speak out who you are, you would discover that you are not alone.
I wanted to bring in your lawyer, Keegan Stefan. In one of Trump's first executive orders, January 20th, was to restore the death penalty, Trump said, which includes the order that the attorney general ensures all states have necessary drugs. This is Keith's second execution date. What is it? January 13th, 2027. If you can explain what happens right now in court, where the case stands in court, and the role of the Ohio governor, Mike DeWine, the position he has taken, since he, not Trump, would decide what happens ultimately to Keith Lamar.
Yes. Hi, Amy, and thanks for elevating Keith's case. You know, Keith, unfortunately, exhausted his direct appeals long ago. The state courts and federal courts looked at his trial and determined incorrectly that there were no constitutional deficiencies and upheld his conviction and his death sentence. I do think that any fair-minded jurist looking at his trial now would deem it unconstitutional and overturn his convictions. Unfortunately, the only way back into court is to find newly discovered evidence. So me and a team of attorneys have been reviewing all the records in his case and talking to witnesses for the last 2 years, trying to turn up newly discovered evidence. We have discovered a lot of new evidence supporting Keith's innocence. You know, I started as a skeptic. I'm a prison abolitionist, definitely an abolitionist of the death penalty. Doesn't matter to me if he's guilty, he shouldn't be put to death. But I can tell you after looking at the record, talking to witnesses, there is no doubt in my mind that he is actually innocent.
Can you talk about your evolution in prison? You went into prison, when you were 19 years old? Hadn't graduated from high school. Talk about going to school in prison. Talk about happened to you since?
Well, I dropped out in the 10th grade. You know, I was living a hand-to-mouth existence, basically, when the crack epidemic exploded in Cleveland, Ohio, around 1985, 86. When I was around 16 years old or so, I had been living on my own for about a year or so at that time, and I got beat to be immersed in the drug trade. And when I came to prison, after tragic events I got my GED and enrolled in college, but that wasn't really the pivot. You know, the pivot happened when I started my own education. The first serious book I read was The Autobiography of Malcolm X, and that was a pivot. You know, that was a real eye-opening thing. And I was constantly meeting these real brilliant individuals here in prison. They mentored me, became father figures. I joined a boxing team and met the guy who taught me how to play chess. I met this guy who taught me how to write, the difference between a semicolon and an independent clause. I was learning all these things I didn't learn in school. I learned these from other prisoners. You know, that's the misconception that a lot of people have about people in prison, that we're all animals and all this thing, but these are just poor people. And, you know, some of these poor people, when they arrive here, they want to try to understand why they are here. And, you know, I began that quest myself. And when I came to death row, all those things kind of, because I had just went through this experience of a trial, which was nothing short of a mockery. All the evidence was withheld. 22,000 pieces of evidence was burned, as I talk about in the movie. All the, you know, conflicting statements that challenged the state's characterization of the facts was suppressed. you know, an all-white jury wasn't paneled, and during the whole trial, the courtroom remained empty. It was only when it was time to sentence me to death that people showed up. So the community wasn't concerned about the evidence. They were just concerned about the day in which they would be able to watch the lynching. And it wasn't until months later when I was already on death row that I actually saw those famous lynching pictures that you see in books and whatnot. And I knew it was something that I had just gone through. And so that, along with my reading, I started reading James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Charles Mills, Luke Wancong, Walter Rodney, C.R. James. I started reading all these people, became like active professors in my education, my maturation, and music. You know, my love for music, for jazz grew, you know, simultaneously. You know, with my love of learning and reading and whatnot. And you know, I gradually found my way back to myself. I achieved myself. You know, had I taken the deal, you know, I would have died like something of a premature death, you know, because I would have never realized who I am today. And so I don't have regrets about making that hard decision, but it was ignorance that allowed me to do it. I didn't know what I didn't know about the system, you know, and how it functioned. And, you know, thank God for that. Yeah, because I probably would have taken the easy way out and missed the opportunity to find out who I was, yeah.
I want to bring back Keegan Stefan into this conversation, your lawyer. He's speaking to us from New York City. You're on death row in Ohio State. Keegan, if you could explain when Keith talks about taking the deal the first time and then the second time saying he wanted to go to trial. Explain how that, it's not him going into prison where he went right onto death row. It's after the Lucasville uprising.
Yeah, that's right. So Keith's original crime of conviction, as everyone heard, was for basically a self-defense killing. When he was selling drugs, when he was very young, someone attempted to rob him. He fought back. They shot at him. He shot back. You know, I think most people would deem that a self-defense killing, but under a legal doctrine called unclean hands, he couldn't apply that. His counsel at the time encouraged him to plead guilty, and he did. And then he was sent to Lucasville at a very unfortunate time, right before this uprising occurred. And then these murders got pinned on him. And then when he was being tried for those murders, he was offered a plea deal, which is a wild plea deal in retrospect, that he would have been given time that would have run concurrently with the sentence he was already serving for his original crime of conviction. He would have effectively done no more time. I mean, I think that's a very, very strong signal that they knew they had a weak case, but they just wanted somebody to take the fall. But Keith, you know, stood on his convictions and his innocence and said he wasn't going to do it. He wasn't going to admit to murders he hadn't committed. And that, you know, choices made all the difference. He was convicted despite a trial that was unfair on its face and then turned out to be even more unfair after all of the suppressed evidence came out. As Keith mentioned, you know, after trial, he learned that other people had admitted to some of the murders that he was convicted of committing, but those confessions weren't turned over in a usable form. Many other people said, you know, who did the murders and didn't name Keith. That incredibly exculpatory evidence was not turned over in a usable form. All of that was found and used on appeals, but his convictions were upheld in some very unjust decisions. Now his only way back into court is through newly discovered evidence and another motion starting in the state court, which is going to take time to litigate, which is what his legal team, including myself, are working on now.
And of course, the death date is set for January 13th, 2027. Keegan, can you talk about President Trump's executive order? I think it was on the first day, on January 20th, where he tried to make sure the attorney general gets execution drugs to the states. In fact, that's why Keith Lamar's first execution date was vacated, because Ohio didn't have the drugs to inject in him.
Yes. It's a horrifying executive order. I think it exemplifies that the cruelness is the point of this administration. You know, many drug companies are sort of uncomfortable providing the drugs that are used to effect executions in this country. And for that reason, Ohio has been unable to execute people since Governor DeWine has taken office. It's horrifying, and it may in fact enable Ohio to move forward with executions, which could likely make Keith's current execution date a very real execution date, which is a absolutely terrifying prospect. I've spent time with Keith on death row.
How do you live with the specter, Keith Lamar, over your head, the specter of death, that there is a date for you to die?
The test to your existence is daunting. I won't even try to, you know, deny that. You know, but if I focus too much on it, Amy, it will immobilize me. It will stop me or prevent me from doing the things that need to be done. You know, a lot of times when you see guys in my situation, you very seldom hear from them directly. There's always someone else speaking for them, and sometimes that's because there's rules to prevent you from speaking on your behalf. But we filed a lawsuit, and so I'm perfectly within my rights to do what I'm doing, you know, to speak out for my life, and I tend to do that, you know. Thinking about what you just asked Keegan about the executive order, and you know, it's maddening. It's maddening when you think about, you know, here's a person who, you know, rants and raves about the injustice of the system when it relates to him personally. And yet you see the overhaul that's going on where there's no awareness or connection to his own personal experience. I mean, if he is to believe the system is corrupt, and yet the same person is arming this very corrupt system to take other people's lives, human beings' lives. But it's on par or of the piece with everything else that flows from the system and where we are right now, with the direction that we are moving in right now as a country. You know, but me personally, you know, I have all these amazing people who are actually fighting with me, not for me, but with me. And for that, I'm really, really, I'm truly grateful. You know, I try not to dwell too much on you know, the execution date. You know, because I don't want to give it validity, you know, where that becomes a self-fulfilling thing in my life. I want to move in the opposite direction and push against that, you know, in every way possible. Yeah.
I wanted to bring Amy Gordeev into this conversation. She's the director of the Justice for Keith Lamar Foundation, speaking to us, I believe, also from Youngstown, but not inside the prison, outside. She's a high school teacher. Amy, can you talk about what the Justice for Keith Lamar Foundation is and the kind of global outreach that Keith has been able to do from prison with the support, as he said it, of people working with him?
Thank you so much for having me on, Amy. Justice for Keith Lamar has evolved. It used to be just a group of friends and supporters here in Ohio, and it was kind of a slogan we had. But in time, as our movement grew, we really realized we needed to develop this into something more organized. And so we are now a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to bring healing and support to those who are wrongfully convicted. And so as Keith has advocated for himself, it really, for me, I saw a lot of returns after he published his book, Condemned. It just meant that people knew his story and wanted to be, you know, more involved with him, you know, just engaging in their various platforms. And ultimately, the music led us to different continents, all over the world, really. And it's been really a very, very beautiful, meaningful thing to be able to involve more and more people who hear his story. And again, what Keith said is so true, that he is rare in this area, because so often someone is talked about and they sit out of reach and out of our earshot. And here's Keith advocating for himself at every step of the way.
I want to go back to Keith Lamar live on death row at the Ohio State Penitentiary in Youngstown, not far from where Amy is right now, who's about to teach in high school in Youngstown. Keith, I'm looking at an article in the New York Times from a few years ago. Jazz freed Keith Lamar's soul. Can it help him get off death row? And it says with concerts and a new album, musicians are trying to draw attention to the case of an inmate convicted in the death of five other prisoners who they believe deserves a new trial. And it talks about you're working together with jazz musicians, with some of the greats like Albert Marquez, who's the pianist, composer, New York City school teacher, people like Brian Jackson, Salim Washington, Arturo Farrell, Carolyn Davis, who are involved with these Freedom First concerts and the concerts that'll lead up to the big event at Joe's Pub on May 31st, your 56th birthday. What's it like to make this music together? You with the poetry. I saw the picture in your room. You've got a keyboard?
Yeah, I have a keyboard. You know, and a beginner's manual on how to play it, which because of all the things you mentioned, I haven't really had too much time. But it's aspirational more than anything, to be honest. Yeah.
So how do you work together?
Well, same way how I'm working with you right now. You know, I'm sitting here wedged between the toilet and the door. And it's, you know, it's a real uncomfortable position, but, you know, I have my eyes closed. I have on a pair of earbuds, and, you know, I just leave it all to, you know, the universe, you know, whatever. You know, it's amazing. I mean, it shouldn't be possible. I say that in the lyrics. You know, it shouldn't even be doable, the things that we are doing. You know, Albert Marquez, who you mentioned, had the idea, you know, after exchanging letters with me, that we could probably collaborate, you know, in this particular medium to, you know, elevate my story.
Can you talk about your book clubs? Students around the country, high school kids meeting with you to talk about books. Explain how it works.
Well, the same way I'm talking to you now, I call in and a group of, you know, young people are gathered in the classroom. You know, when I initially started the book club, it was an attempt to pinpoint or go back and see where things went wrong in my own life. When I was 13, I was sent away to a juvenile facility for 6 months. And, you know, I had all the things that was that is prevalent with young people, like myself, you know, dysfunctional childhood, abuse, and all those things were present. But I'm thinking about what can I do? When was the opportunity for me to intervene and change the trajectory of my life? And although I started reading seriously when I was in my 20s, I thought that maybe if I can get some books back to my 13-year-old self, that maybe I can change the trajectory of that young person's life. And so I started off going into juvenile facilities here in Ohio. And that ultimately grew into this thing where I was, you know, going to high schools, because I also realized that I was in high school and I wasn't learning anything. You know, it's this thing that Carl Jung talked about, directed thinking and fantasy thinking. And I was absorbed in the fantasy side of it. I didn't really know how to connect the dots. And reading was the thing that allowed me to kind of cultivate that sense. And so I wanted to give that as a gift to young people to help them navigate the complexity, because life is complicated. And it is even more complicated when you are poor and disadvantaged, marginalized, and all those other things. And reading, particularly autobiographies, you know, is the thing that helped me. And so I wanted to somehow go back and provide this material to young people.
Keith, thank you very much for spending this time with us live from death row from the Ohio State Prison in Youngstown, Ohio.
Thank you for using GTL.
Ooh, that's what he hears a lot when he's on the phone. Keith Lamar speaking from death row in Ohio. He's scheduled to be executed in 2027. On May 31st, a concert will be held at Joe's Pub here in New York to mark the release of his new album, Live from Death Row. Keith will perform from Death Row, along with the jazz pianist Albert Marquez and others. We also spoke to his lawyer, Keegan Stefan, and Amy Gordeo, director of the Justice for Keith Lamar Foundation. And that does it for today's show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.